From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, it's Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The impeachment proceedings on Capitol Hill, a new indicators of a warming climate, the battle over a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico, the handling of migrants who've crossed the border, what will happen in the 2020 race for the White House. These are all arguably worth discussion as the big stories of 2019, but a great deal happened in southeastern North Carolina. It's the local stories that broke and are still unfolding that we'll explore today. Project Grace, the controversial redesign of an entire city block in downtown Wilmington, the embattled public transportation system, the possible sale of a county-owned hospital, the development of Wilmington's North Riverfront area, including a public park that has shrunk in amenities and grown in price, and the tension between citizens and local governments over transparency. These are some of the issues that grabbed headlines this year and will continue to unfold in 2020. We'll pull back the curtain today on how local reporters approach local stories, perhaps how you can do a better job of vetting the sources of news you consume, and what the data continues to show about the correlation between shrinking local newsrooms, higher levels of governmental malfeasance, and lower voter turnout and civic engagement. We're doing this today with our friends and partners at Port City Daily. Joining me now, Ben Schachtman. He's managing editor of Port City Daily. Ben, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Port City Daily reporter Michael Pratz. Michael, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think the biggest story of the year was for the Cape Fear region? What do you think local news media didn't cover or unpack as thoroughly as they could have? If you were assignment manager, where would you send us? Email us during this live Wednesday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. We have to start with New Hanover Regional Medical Center, the hospital. Ben, you published a really excellent piece that quantified what we know now, what we know about the potential implications, what the open questions still are. There have been a lot of concerns raised over transparency, the degrees of transparency that have accompanied this process. But first, for folks who haven't followed this story, just tell us on the face of it, what is the potential sale of the hospital about? Is it going to be sold?
Sure. So I wish I could tell you concretely what exactly would happen. I know we were all kind of surprised in July when the county announced that they were going to explore it. And one of the things we've brought up a couple times is that the process is kind of guided by state law. There's a couple steps you have to do. One of them is this thing called a resolution of intent to sell, which could end up in you selling the hospital, finding a new managing partner, a new minority partner, or keeping it the way it is.
But that, so there are a whole bunch of configurations that could result from this. But the title of that resolution has been confusing for a lot of members of the public.
It was very confusing, but not on its own. I think it was that combined with revelations that came shortly after the county's announcement that this had been discussed in these one-on-one and two-on-two meetings with county commissioners for months, and that the public was not hearing about this at the beginning of the process, but kind of in the middle of the process.
And that's an element of this that you looked at pretty closely, the serial meeting idea versus actual public discussions and work sessions. And you asked a local government expert about when serial meetings, and those are meetings that would not trigger sunshine laws.
Right. So you don't have a quorum. It's not an official meeting. And for better or worse, the county and the city of Wilmington and many other government bodies do this all the time. The trick is if you have a majority, if you have 3 out of 5 or 4 out of 7 members at the same place in the same time, and they're talking about government business, you got to keep minutes, you got to keep a record of it, you got to announce it to the public. And one philosophy in government is that that is a roadblock to getting things done. One of the issues that we've heard sort of off the record is that it's very difficult to get candid. Look at the Afghanistan papers, right? Those people all thought they were talking off the record, so they gave very candid evaluations of the war in Afghanistan. Shrink that down to the local scale. You have, you know, what is the hospital's financial situation really going to be in 10 years? If it's in a public meeting, you're going to get, you know, a more polished, less adventurous, possibly less honest answer. So these meetings were, okay, the tape isn't rolling. There are no minutes. It's just these two commissioners and maybe two people from the hospital and some staff members. Okay, tell us what's really going on. And that allows you to get the information you need to, you know, make an informed decision down the line. That's one philosophy. The other philosophy is that this is horrible and that this is really government being done behind closed doors. It's literally government being done behind closed doors. So whether or not you like that process, it's worth knowing it's not limited to the hospital sale. That's the county's decisions on the ABC store, on CFCC, on a lot of issues.
This, you talked to somebody who said, and Jones is the last name of this person, but Jones said, I have some concerns about commissioners meeting in serial meetings, talking specifically about this issue, and said the principle behind the open meetings law is that business should be conducted in public. And so when the attitude becomes we need to meet in groups of one or two, it sounds like you're coming to some conclusion, at least as an individual, before you ever engage in public discussion, which I think has been the pushback over this.
Yeah. And Michael and I have both seen this. It's very rare that you see an idea get introduced, discussed, and resolved in open, in public, in a government meeting. Most meetings you go to are pretty well choreographed. Sometimes that happens in an agenda meeting, but often that happens behind the scenes. You know, so they go through the motions in an agenda review meeting or in a public meeting. But I would say it's incredibly rare that that's the first time any of those commissioners or council members or aldermen have heard of that idea. So specifically about the hospital, that's a conversation they've been having since Jack Bartow was the CEO of New Hanover Regional Medical Center. So for years, and there's no start or stop date. People had this idea that there was maybe this nefarious single event where a single actor said, we're going to sell the hospital, and everything else is window dressing and dog and pony shows. And I think it's more that these are conversations that have happened out of the public eye for a long time.
There are also questions about the non-disclosure agreements that have been, and I understand that there were two versions of non-disclosure agreements signed by New Hanover County commissioners. Can you talk about that and what role those have played in the information that the public has had access to?
Sure. So two things I would say. One, a lot of this, the information that they were shown, from what I understand, county commissioners were shown potential offers from other hospital systems. Here's what we might get from HCA or Novant or something like that. Because that's not part of a public bid process, that's protected by privacy laws. So as I understand it, some of the commissioners were asked to sign non-disclosure agreements and some weren't. And I feel like that has to do with whether or not they thought those commissioners would respect the process or whether or not they thought that process was unfair to the public.
And what was the difference between some of those? I saw WECT reported on the fact that, for instance, Commissioner Patricia Kusak was holding up non-disclosure agreements that she had signed and that Rob Zappel had signed. And full disclosure, Rob Zappel is a member of WHQR's board of directors. But upon closer inspection, those two NDAs were different and were signed in different periods of time as it relates to this hospital potential sale.
To be honest, I'd have to go back and read it again. I believe it was one was an NDA from the hospital and one was an NDA from the county. Either one would be binding, I suppose. But the only repercussion for breaking the NDA would be, in theory, someone could sue you.
Right.
But I think there was a lot of, you know, the NDAs were one part of a system of privacy that they had in place to try and keep some of this. And the argument at the end of the day is if information about the financials of the hospital sale become public, it may cause the county to not get the best deal possible. For people who are in favor of secrecy, that's usually the argument.
And then one more element of this. Recently-ish, a nonprofit sprung up to oppose the sale of the hospital. Can you just tell us about that, what their role is?
It's Gene Merritt, who's been involved in downtown Wilmington and Wilmington area politics for a long time. I think Gene made himself kind of the focal point for a lot of different concerned parties, from physicians at the hospital to community members. I don't think Gene believed the sort of party line, the county line, was that this was all going to be an open, transparent process, and that there was, you know, it could just as easily end in retaining county ownership of the hospital as it could in a full sale. That there was a broad spectrum of possibilities, and anything was possible. I think he thought essentially an agreement had kind of been reached, but that they had to, by law, go through the formal process. I think that's still sort of his attitude.
And that has been a perception on the part of other members of the public, too, especially the way the news dropped with this could be a $1 billion cash infusion for New Hanover County.
I think immediately speculating about what you would do with the money from a sale makes it difficult to say that we're considering all options. If you're already spending mentally the money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk more in a little while about how some of the other local government boards and commissions are approaching the process of working in the public eye and dealing with transparency, because I think we've all observed that, especially in the last municipal elections, that issue arose as a built-in tension between members of the public. And we saw in Southport, for instance, a complete change in government there. And Michael Pratz, I know you've been reporting on Carolina Beach, so when we come back, we'll hear what the latest is there.
All right.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a reporter roundtable with Port City Daily's Ben Schachtman and Michael Pratz. When we come back from this break, if you'd like to ask a question about a story we covered this year, you can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Or if there's a story you think we should cover, let us know. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's a reporter roundtable with Ben Schachtman and Michael Pratz of Port City Daily, and we want to hear from you on this Wednesday. Which local stories broke in 2019 that made an impression on you, worried you, maybe got you more involved in local issues? You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Michael Pratz, you've been covering Carolina Beach, which is a municipality in New Hanover County, and they have a new mayor.
They do.
As a result of the elections. Mm-hmm. Tell us about her.
Yeah, so Leanne Pierce was actually a sitting councilwoman for the town of Carolina Beach. She served, I believe it's the past two terms, and she just decided to run for mayor this year. Joe Benson served his 2 years and decided he did not want to run for re-election. So she threw her hat in the ring along with four other candidates, came out on top. She is the first female mayor in Carolina Beach, which is big news for them. But what was, somewhat interesting with this process of a sitting council member running for mayor and actually winning is the fact that her seat was then vacated. So essentially, you have a two-year seat that is not filled, because during the elections, you have to run with the assumption she's not, it's anybody's game.
Right. And it was interesting. In an earlier story, you reported on a state statute that council can appoint to fill that seat, but there are no requirements about the timeline. And so council essentially has this choice. Tell us about the choice.
Right. So the choice is, for county issues, there is a state statute that says you have to fill that vacancy within 60 days. For municipalities, it says you shall fill it, but it doesn't say when. So it does leave that open to interpretation, which gives council members the opportunity to hold, month-long processes like an application system to find, who they think is the best candidate. That's one option. The other option is actually what happened in Carolina Beach. You make an appointment, and if it gets the majority vote from the rest of the council members, that person immediately becomes, fills that vacated seat.
And there is an argument to be made for waiting until the next election.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's always an argument. I think the argument I did speak with Leanne Pierce and some of the other council members that said because this was, you know, a month after an election and, you know, the person they ended up appointing, Steve Shuttleworth, actually only lost by, I want to say, 6 or 7 votes. They said that was close enough for them to be comfortable with appointing him, which they did, you know, because the election just happened. Now, in situations where, you know, a member vacates their seat, you know, in an even year or something like that, then a lot of council members do say, let's wait till the next election. It's coming up in 9 months. We'll just go without. But that was not the case in Carolina Beach.
Do you think there's going to be any pushback over the appointment, not opening it up to applications?
You know, I really don't. I was at the meeting last night. Steve Shuttleworth was nominated. He got he did have a little bit of opposition from Councilman Jodan Garza. And I spoke with Jodan. I speak with him frequently. And he is, if anything, he is principled. And since campaign season, he has said, you know, if Leanne does win, I want to go with the application process. He said he thinks it's the most fair. It's the best way to find a viable candidate. And he stuck by that. He voted against it last night. He was the sole dissenting vote. To appoint Steve Shuttleworth. But outside of that, it seems like the community really rallied behind Steve, and the votes also, you know, kind of speak for that. With the 7-7 vote loss, he did have, you know, a pretty hefty support from the community.
You know, that's something that's always interesting to me in municipal elections, is that a seat can be won or lost by just a handful of votes, sometimes 1 or 2.
Right.
It really does affirm the idea that civic engagement is so important.
Absolutely.
I especially in Wilmington, we saw Paul Lawler and Neil Anderson separated ultimately by 5 votes. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, a newsroom could have gone out and changed that election. We didn't do that, but we could have gone out and changed that election. It's kind of wild.
Yeah. So looking at the Wilmington city elections, this was the first time that Mayor Bill Sappho had really had an opponent who gave him a run for his money. I mean, this was not a shoe. He was a real contender.
It's been about 10 years, so 5 election cycles, since I think Mayor Sappho has had to go out, do TV commercials, as we talked about last time, do campaign events. And, you know, whether or not you support him, I do think it forced more dynamic conversations. If you're unopposed and you've been unopposed for years, your past performance is kind of your mandate. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. It's very, very unusual to see any candidate who has been an incumbent and unchallenged for years say, you know what, I'm gonna mix it up. I'm going to try some new stuff. It doesn't usually happen. And I like to think that at least in the coming years, we'll see some new ideas from the mayor. Maybe that things he picked up on the campaign trail, ideas that he liked.
Yeah. And when we look at this big park, arguably the biggest project to be undertaken by the city of Wilmington in quite a while, you guys have done a lot of reporting on this, the North Riverfront Park, the fact that it has shrunk in amenities and grown in budget. Can you just sort of, for people who haven't really heard about the park before, tell us what it is and what its purpose is, Michael?
Sure. The North Waterfront Park, as it's called, and I believe it's changed names from Riverfront to Waterfront a couple times, but it's I believe it's like a 6.6 acre lot of land by the Isabel Holmes Bridge that is going to, it was approved by the 2016 Parks Bond. The city earmarked $20 million for this project. Along the way, they decided they wanted to build an amphitheater for music events. Live Nation is going to be the one controlling this venue. And it's, you know, it was supposed to be a public open space that could be used for private concerts occasionally. But it was really just supposed to be this, you know, this gem of the city, so to speak.
And what is it now?
Supposed
to be.
Well, now it is still just a vacant lot. I believe they did stick some shovels in the dirt this past Monday. But for now, it's been pushed back several times. Construction was supposed to begin over a year ago. Between hurricanes, budgets, design elements, sending things back out for bids, it's been severely delayed. It still is planned to be this, you know, gem. However, there are some things that are going to be cut amenity-wise that we were, you know, as city residents were promised that we're going to be included in it.
And what are some of those things we know about that are
so cut? The two major things that we know that they're planning on cutting out, the first is this public dock system that they were going to have that boaters could come up, maybe catch a concert, grab a hot dog or a beer, hang out on the lawn, and then boat away. That's no longer a thing. The next part is the public art portion of the park. I believe it was going to be some art walkway type deal. Now, these are things that the city has said these can be added in the future. It doesn't mean they will be added in the future. But those are the two main things we know that they've done away with. They've also done some value engineering, which is a term just for, you know, cutting costs, essentially. So I think they were talking about doing granite curbs, you know, kind of like we see in the old Front Street. Big granite curbs, they're switching that to concrete curbs. Things along those lines where you can save a little bit of money, still make it aesthetically pleasing. But, you know, things are changing.
What is the story with public parking and this park?
This is a question we've been asking for years. And the first time we asked, we actually kind of got laughed out of the room. We were told by certain staff members from the city, you know, like, that's not a concern.
Or public parking isn't a concern. I'm sorry. So if let me just go back for a second. This venue.
7,000 people venue.
7,000 people venue. Okay. And public parking isn't a concern because there will be what? Public transportation? That's being cut. How will this, where will people park? How will they get to the park?
It's a fabulous question. I think it was a year and a half ago we asked Mayor Sapho this, and he told us that, now we should say that there has been on the back burner for the city of Wilmington a need-based project for public parking in that part of the city for years. It hasn't scored well, and it's never been funded. It's just sort of one of the city's many dream projects. But when we asked Mayor Sapho, I think it was about a year and a half ago, where are these 7,000 people going to park? His answer was largely that private development would take care of it and that he expected a number of properties in the area would include parking decks, which has been borne out. There's a Kettler property that's immediately bordering it. There's the Gateway project that East West Partners, who also developed River Place, are developing. And each of them will probably have a couple hundred parking spots that may be available to the public. That doesn't stack up to me.
A couple hundred.
Yeah. So to me, it's still, and this is my personal opinion.
That's a lot of carpooling.
It feels like Uber. It feels like putting an inordinate amount of faith in carpooling, or Uber's going to have to open up a headquarters here.
Yeah.
I just don't.
Economic development possibility there.
There we go.
That's true.
Which leads to a question that somebody posted on Facebook. Jim asked, where are all the big economic development projects that and he's been involved, I think, in the entrepreneurial part of this community.
I think I know which Jim you mean.
Foster startups. And he was just asking, you know, with all of the money, the public money that does go to some of these economic development initiatives, where are the projects? What are some of the biggest economic development projects underway now?
So, I mean, there was National Gypsum, there's PPD, there's the Galleria project, technically falls under sort of economic incentive. Every year the city, so that was, that part of it was that the city of Wilmington actually pays the city, or the town of Wrightsville Beach, for the lost tax revenue for having annexed the Galleria property. So every year we give them $20,000+, and we will for another 20 years, I think, with the idea that that will generate tax revenue and jobs and so on and so forth. Also, every year, the city budget includes a number of economic development partners. And this is something we saw a lot of criticism aimed at during the election. So there's the Wilmington Downtown Incorporated. The city is currently trying to work out a way to give $10,000 to the Downtown Business Association, although they're not technically a nonprofit. There's also the, I think, Wilmington Business Development. And all of these sort of have different roles. And I think one of the points that we keep coming back to, at least in the newsroom, is that you remember, there was the Garner report at the county level that sort of mapped out the region's economic future.
The 2014 economic development strategy.
Yeah, really dense reading, but some really amazing insights in there. And one of them is that the phrase used was balkanized, Which, if you're not an Olympics member, there was a mountain range called the Balkans, where there was a lot of countries that didn't get around. But the region's economic development groups were balkanized. There was too many of them. Mm-hmm. It wasn't clear what the specific mandate for each one of them were, how they worked in concert, or in general what they were doing.
And it was suggesting that the county take that ball and run with it.
Yeah, and again, it remains unclear to us whenever a big... So, for example, let's take National Gypsum. This is one of the fastest growing regions in the country, which means a lot of new houses, which means a lot of drywall, which is what National Gypsum builds the raw materials for. They already had a plant here ready to go. It was just turned off. Otherwise, they were probably going to do some aesthetic upgrades and maybe, you know, update some of the technology. But they had a functioning plant ready to go with a rail spur right next to it. Their other option was to sort of build some new facilities in Florida or to reactivate another facility in Florida. Which was experiencing a building downturn at the time. So the idea that we would give them give them city and county money to encourage them to do something that appeared to be an obvious move already and generate maybe 50 jobs, you can see how that would frustrate the average person who, A, didn't get a job at National Gypsum, and B, wonders why do that at all.
You're listening to Coastline Today. It's a reporter roundtable with Ben Jockman and Michael Pratz of Port City Daily. We want to hear from you during this live Wednesday discussion. Was there a local story that broke this year that changed the way you thought about your own civic engagement? Tell us about it by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. Victoria wrote in, will the North Riverfront Park be closed to the public during events to Wilmington citizens? In the contract, it mentions this, and she says, I believe they already had up to 15 weeks of events. Also, is there any concern with Live Nation running it with the multiple lawsuits against them in other states for negligence in the way they handle security and fair pay? New York did a whole inquiry into them, as well as for the way they handle tickets. There have been lawsuits against Live Nation, certainly in terms of their management of the ticketing process. I know about that. I don't know about the security and fair pay questions that she mentions here. But have there been any local questions raised in regards to who the city of Wilmington is getting involved with?
Yeah, and that's a question that we've been looking at, and this actually, so let me back up and answer the first part of that question. The Riverfront Park will be open to the public during events the concerts will be taking place behind a gate, temporary gate fence. You can still probably hear the music from where you can sit, but you won't be able to get that experience. That was a question, I believe, on an addendum to the proposals that were submitted to manage the park. So yes, the park will, for all intents and purposes, be open if it's not within the gated area. Now, as far as getting involved with Live Nation, there have been some questions, and this actually goes back to our current amphitheater, Hugh Morton Amphitheater, which there's been a lot of talk lately with the city, proposing a new management contractor to take over operations, day-to-day operations, security, concessions, ticket sales, that sort of thing, at what we just most people know as Greenfield Lake Amphitheater. What a lot of people don't know, there's been a lot of, we see it all the time on Facebook with comments, emails, things like that. People are, adverse towards Live Nation. There's that, that idea that Greenfield Lake is this small community amphitheater and it's doing a great job. Don't change the way things are going. Something a lot of people don't know, 40 of the 60-something shows last year were Live Nation produced events. So these little local shows that everybody seems to love, they're already, using Live Nation. So Live Nation is here. It's not necessarily, this unknown boogeyman that's coming to run this massive multi-million-dollar project. But we do have some questions as far as the city's involvement with Live Nation. And that goes back to talks from 2018, where, we saw some city emails where the community director, Amy Betty, had, been in discussions with Grant Lyman, president of Live Nation in the North Carolina region, about managing the amphitheater. At that time, she said that was just an off-the-cuff idea. It wasn't going to come to fruition. Fast forward to October, where they, you know, asked for proposals to manage Greenfield Lake. You know, it makes us sit here and we wonder, is this that deal coming to life? Especially because there was $2 million involved in this discussion, which was going to be from Live Nation to the North Waterfront Park Amphitheater to increase the back of the house size. So, you know, there's definitely some questions. And unfortunately, the city has been very unwilling to answer a lot of these questions we have. The RFPs, the proposals were due last week. In general, you know, we ask to see who submitted a proposal and, you know, to repave the streets. They send them right over. It's been over a week now, and we still have yet to hear from the city who submitted proposals to run Hugh Morton Amphitheater. It's been crickets.
We were actually directed by the deputy city attorney to file a public records request. And I believe the way she phrased it was, as per the usual policy for requesting documents. And as Michael's pointing out, that's not usually. We usually have a very good working relationship with the city. And if we want something that is a public document, we ask and their communication team provides it. It helps us report, helps them get information out, and it benefits everyone. In this case, the communication office didn't even respond. We were redirected to legal, who told us to file a records request. We asked yesterday and today by email if they could at least tell us who had applied, who had submitted proposals. And there was two questions. One, can we come by and say hi? And two, can you tell us who applied? And they only answered one of those questions. And it wasn't the one we wanted answered.
Did you go by and say hi?
Right after this.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a reporter roundtable with Ben Schachtman and Michael Pratz of Port City Daily. We're taking a closer look at some of the stories that broke in 2019 and a closer look at some of the questions that still confront us involved in those stories. If you'd like to weigh in during the live Wednesday discussion, you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this break, we're going to hear from Melissa, and it's the last segment, so last chance for you to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. 2019 was an election year for municipalities in the Cape Fear region anyway. We also thought we'd see plans for a third crossing over the Cape Fear River. We saw those scuttled. We watched plans unfold for Wilmington's largest riverfront development project in over a decade. We learned New Hanover County is considering divesting itself of the hospital or reorganizing. With me today to take a closer look at some of those big stories and those that deserved more attention than they got, Ben Schachtman, he's managing editor of Port City Daily. Michael Pratz is a reporter for Port City Daily. What stories made an impression on you this year? You can email us during the live Wednesday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. Melissa writes, thanks for the great show. Strong need for a new building for Isaac Bear Early College, and UNCW's refusal to prioritize this need is a story I really feel needs more attention. She writes, the recent proposal by UNCW to move Isaac Bear across College Road and ask the county to pay $1.5 million for the proposed trailers and move is in desperate need of more public attention, in my opinion. Ben Schachtman, that story's on your radar.
Very much so. And I have never seen so many elected officials on one email chain as I have with some of the emails about this issue that have been forwarded to me. I will say this. We're looking into it. We'll hopefully have a story coming out in the new year with some more comprehensive information and history on it, just because there are so many moving pieces. The biggest thing for me is why this thing has become such a toxic political football. No one seems to want to touch this issue. I've seen city elected officials, county elected officials, state representatives, the governor's office are all part of this conversation. It seems like a win-win. It's a very well-respected school, produces 100% graduation rate, with some of the top scores in the region. These are some of the best students in the region, in New Hanover County. And they are doing all of this, you know, eating in a crowded outside cafeteria in these sort of modular units in a parking lot to the side of UNCW. So it seems like a win-win. So it's good for New Hanover County Schools. It's good for UNCW.
So what's underneath the surface here? What are we missing about why?
That is what we are trying to figure out, is why they are at loggerheads over what to do with this. There's been a number of suggestions. One is that the school doesn't own the land. And so Superintendent Dr. Tim Markley has repeatedly said that he cannot build on land he doesn't own. I can't find any statutory thing to support that. Certainly, it doesn't seem to be any legal reason why a school wouldn't be able to build on leased land. But that has been the school district's explanation. And the current plan that Melissa brought up is to sort of put it in another parking lot behind the Taco Bell, which does not sound fabulous, behind the Taco Bell on South College Road. And this just seems like another delay. It's been over 10 years, yeah. I think, is what the parents are frustrated at. And it's always been suggested that this school not only deserves but will get a permanent building. The parents have all been told, we want to move forward. We want to keep the Isaac Bear program going. We want to give you a permanent building. And then it seems like the conversation ends there. So we are at work. We still have a lot of questions we need answered.
The Project Grace issue was a controversial one when it seemed to be alive. Is it alive? And is it? And just for people who don't know, this was the county proposal to basically redesign, rebuild an entire city block in downtown Wilmington that currently includes a county-owned parking garage and a branch of the new Hanover County Library. Michael Pratz, where is that now?
So the project, it is still alive. It's kind of in limbo right now. I did reach out to the county's communications team a couple weeks ago, actually, just to kind of check in, see where we were with it. It turns out the Zimmer Company, which is the design developer behind the project that the county has hired, is still working, but as I said, it's in limbo. It did face a lot of resistance. I think it was back in 2017 when they first revealed Project Grace. There was a lot of hype about it, but there was also a lot of pushback that actually led to these community organized meetings that actually took place in the library that you're talking about, that basically says, don't demolish the library that we already have. We don't need to spend this money. A lot of people were saying this was just the county's attempt to do something like the River Place mixed-use development that the city has gotten involved with. So, you know, it seemed like the county was going forward with actually the most expensive plan for Project Grace. And then seemingly out of nowhere, they pulled the reins on it and full stop. They clearly heard from the community that this was not what they wanted. That's where we are now. It's just in limbo.
And there were questions, too, during that whole process about the transparency and what had been worked out up to a certain point. I mean, we certainly heard from members of the community that they felt this had just been dropped almost as a fully baked idea before there was really any community engagement. Is that a fair complaint?
That is absolutely fair, because I remember when we went to the press conference, I attended it. The design company was there. Chris Coudray was there. We had a lot of higher-ups that were, you know, releasing this to the media ahead of time before they released it to the public. And they had full-on, you know, renderings. They had designs already pre-built, at least on paper, and four different options. So it was clear the county had been exploring this far before any of this had taken place, because, you know, rendering designs and architecture is not an overnight process that you can just doodle out and, you know, there's a stick figure and that's where the library is going to go. And this was, you know, a pretty comprehensive PowerPoint presentation with facts, figures, and blueprints. So.
And, you know, this goes to questions about New Hanover County Board of Commissioners' recent move to eliminate agenda briefings, just as a matter of course, for all of 2020. This is something that they just did, I think, at their last meeting. And there's one argument behind that that says this has nothing to do with transparency, because all of our actual regular Board of Commissioner meetings are videotaped and the audio and the video is available on the website. Not so with the agenda briefings. And then there's this other school of thought that says you're actually taking away public involvement here and you are removing one of the components of public officials working together at what would essentially be a work session. But Ben Schachtman, you said earlier in this discussion that even in agenda briefings, they're not real work sessions. The work doesn't happen in that kind of a public setting.
When they are, they're labeled as such. You'll actually see on the agenda, it'll be, you know, like Monday morning, 8 o'clock work session, and they'll block out 3 hours to work on an issue. But yeah, you're totally right. For your average agenda meeting, they're kind of going through stuff that they've already had discussions about. And I think one of the things I'm kind of torn about this personally is that we've occasionally been critical of the city of Wilmington of doing things, of making, you know, taking votes on issues in agenda meetings. It's not illegal. It's not unethical according to the School of Government Rules of Ethics, but it is something that no one knows about. People do not go to these things. The press knows about them. We go and we use it to build our reporting for a few stories later in the week. Mm-hmm. But it's not doing it in darkness. It's doing it in the shade, for sure. On the other hand, and this is Rob Zappel's point, but he was in favor of keeping the agenda meetings, is that it is kind of a midpoint between the real conversations that no one ever gets to see, when two commissioners probably meet and say, hey, let's talk about funding for WAVE or something like that. And then the final vote, which is usually very scripted and choreographed.
Right.
In the middle, you get the opportunity to see a little back and forth. Sometimes it's a little for show. Sometimes it's legitimate. But what's important is that they can ask questions. So if you watch the video of the New Hanover County's decision to cut the $300,000 in county funding from WAVE, whatever you think about that, if you watch how unprepared County Manager Chris Coudray was to answer serious questions about what would this mean, how would this even work logistically, how much money are we talking about, which route, and he was able to answer some of them. He's a bright guy and he's quick on his feet, but there were some things that he just didn't have time to figure out.
And well, you've just brought another component of this into it, which is dropping major policy items into that miscellaneous kind of blank slot at the end of meetings. So it doesn't even wind up on the agenda for the regular commission meeting. I mean, does that raise questions about transparency and what's happening behind closed doors?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, any time that you have a major decision that's going to affect, I mean, potentially hundreds of thousands of residents that you put into the additional items, typically additional items, what we see can be something like, oh, I wanted to say thank you for, you know, this person for working so hard on this project, or, you know, minor little things that perhaps giving the town manager some sort of direction, say, for Carolina Beach, for example, they say, hey, you know, we heard in the public comment they asked about parking. Will you look into this for us and bring us something at our next council meeting? Typically, you don't see something as significant as, you know, I vote we do away with funding for public transit.
Is there an ethical question there? I mean, at what point do you draw the line and say this is going to affect the public, or this is a major decision and it needs to go in the regular agenda at the very least? I mean, what's the ethical line there?
For me, there's absolutely an ethical question there, especially, you know, there was no information provided to the media who, you know, we help get this information to the public. There have been no previous discussion or any sort of allusions leading up to this. So, yeah, it's a huge decision that didn't get any input from the community before taking a vote. I'd say that's absolutely a question of ethics. Now, legality, not so much, but ethically, absolutely.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, I mean, how we do our job is that we need some heads up so that we can do our research, so you don't just get verbatim quotes, you know, and a couple of condensed paragraphs. Like, if we're going to investigate, for example, you know, what a decision about public transportation or Project Grace or anything that's being dropped on these final minute suggestions, we then have to do that research retrospectively. So if it happens on a Monday night, on Tuesday morning, we're scrambling trying to get answers from staff who are trying to do the same thing. And it's, you know, a couple, it could be a day, it could be a day and a half after the vote where the public finally starts to figure out what's going on. And that confusion breeds rumors, that confusion breeds misunderstanding. And it's, I mean, I'm not trying to complain about our job is whatever it is, but it's made more difficult and less effective by having to work backwards. Instead of knowing what's going to be on the agenda so we can do the research so that when we report on it, we can put it in context and explain, here's what they voted for, here's what it means.
And there's certainly a difference between following the letter of the law and following the spirit of the law.
We see it every day.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a reporter roundtable with Port City Daily's Ben Schachtman and Michael Pratz. Owen writes, I was wondering if your panel knows when there is going to be further investment in bike lanes.
One of the most shocking things about this job is how expensive bike lanes are. There are a number of bike projects that the city of Wilmington still has planned. Some of them are from the transportation bond. Some of them are just general capital improvement plans. More are coming. The city does actually invest a fair amount of money, and money does kind of show your priorities. There are also a number of unfunded bike projects, including one that would go all the way from the north side to Greenfield Lake along Fifth Avenue. I always forget that it's an avenue. Everything else is a street.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are more coming. There are more planned that aren't funded yet. So it is something the city has invested in. It's incredibly difficult to do, but the city has actually tried to do it.
Jeremy asks, has there been any further comment from NCABC or UNCW about your story? I'm assuming your Port City Daily story showing pay-for-play exclusive deals with local beer distributors.
I haven't heard anything more from that, just to be frank, to answer the question. I'm not sure if you have.
No, and I think the issue there was that it does seem – I don't want to use the term pay-to-play because I believe that's an actual criminal offense.
Yes.
But these large companies were able to provide upfront the amount of beverages that students go through, apparently, and also were able to provide free stuff in trade, free alcohol for events and stuff like that, that maybe smaller businesses wouldn't have been able to provide. So it's not illegal. The question is, should UNCW maybe spend more to highlight local breweries? And, that is ultimately taxpayer money. So the UNCW has to make a decision, should we be financially responsible or should we spend a little more and support the local folks? But
so I do want to touch briefly, we're running out of time here, on the fact that David Leonhardt, a columnist with the New York Times, wrote another column about the importance of local news and highlighted some efforts to bolster local news reporting. And there are multiple studies that show when local news shrinks, there is more public corruption. There is less civic engagement. There's even lower voter turnout. We've seen that happen here. I mean, we've watched the Star News kind of cut their ranks slowly. We know that newsrooms are shrinking across the country. And before we went on the air here, we're talking about the fact that so many of our former colleagues are now in the position of public information officer at a lot of these, in some role along those lines at a lot of government entities. What do we need to do in 2020 with that understanding?
So we have always been We didn't do traditional reporting because there was Star News, NACT, and AY at every government meeting. And so we were trying to do deeper dives and put some of that reporting, which might be a 400 or 500 word brief, in a deeper context. And now I think ECT and Port City Daily have both tried to try to step up the level of just government coverage being at those meetings. There's not enough bodies to do it. It's very challenging. So you sort of have to keep this global view of where the moving parts are, what's important, what do people need to know. It's not enough to just, pick and choose what we want because so much goes under, gets past just the limited number of reporters there are now. So we need a lot more money to hire a lot more people.
And that's this edition of Coastline as we launch our one-day end-of-year pledge drive tomorrow. Ben Schachtman and Michael Pratz of Port City Daily, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Coastline's producer is Caitlin Freund. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Rachel Keith is supervising producer. Marissa Castrino is today's board operator. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.